Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community. Wills. Today on the show, two polarising candidates have gone through to the next stage of French presidential election. Independent Emmanuel and Front National Leader Marine Le Pen will now go head-to-head in the next round in May. Both candidates do not have a base in the legislature. This means France could be facing a president at odds with the parliament.
Well, it's happened before. So it's a scenario called cohabitation. So it's happened a number of times. So it's not unprecedented.
And over the weekend, hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets around the world to march for science. The community is demanding a new politics that accepts scientific objectivity amidst growing distrust towards expert opinion. The Wire attended the rally in Sydney.
When you're banging your head against brick walls, learn to hide bricks. We need to find the politicians who do listen, who will go and talk to them about the broad issues, about what science should be doing, and not just complaining about lack of money.
That's all coming up later on the show. But first, Attorney General George Brandis announced that the federal government had a decision to cut funding to community legal centres earlier today. Its backflip is welcomed by both the opposition and the community legal sector, but has several years of uncertainty regarding funding cuts caused irreversible damage to the future of this sector. Attorney General Senator George Brandis, speaking at a press conference earlier today, has announced the government's commitment to continuing funding legal centres.
This is very good news, not just for the profession and for the sector and all who work in it, but most importantly, very good news for the vulnerable people whom they serve, who will be benefited by an investment of unparalleled magnitude by the Commonwealth in these services.
Following huge backlash from the legal sector, the federal government has finally withdrawn its decision to reduce community service funding by 30%. In what would have been a $55.7 million reduction over 3 years, there were huge concerns for the thousands of disadvantaged Australians who seek free legal advice. But what is a community legal centre? Polly Porteous is the Managing Director of Community Legal Centres New South Wales.
Community legal centres are non-government organisations that provide free legal advice and casework services to disadvantaged people who can't afford to access a lawyer.
The sector is pleased to hear this news. It's an important lifeline that is being thrown out to the sector. But on the other hand, it is a short-term solution, and we're looking forward to working with federal government and also state and territory governments to secure better funding for community legal centres moving into the future.
Naseem Araj, CEO of the National Association of Community Legal Centres, echoes Porteous's sentiments about the importance, as do both sides of politics. Senator Katie Gallagher, Attorney General.
Well, we certainly think this is very welcome news for the sects that have concerned the sector for many years now, at least the last 3 years, and you know they were facing a 30% cut to their operational funding in 8 weeks' time. So this last-minute backflip from Senator Brandis is most welcome, but it's down to the campaign that's been run by the community legal sector more broadly. It's certainly not anything to do with.
So, if everyone's happy, what's all the fuss about? Polly Porteous again.
To start with, it's taken us away from our frontline business of providing legal services. So the bosses of every community legal centre, they're all independent organisations, and the head of each community legal centre has basically spent the last few years trying to stop these cuts. So that's the first thing, is that it's an immense amount of work to actually go to your local politicians and also go to funding bodies elsewhere and argue for more money.
However, as demand for these services is high, maintaining the current level of funding will not relieve community legal centres who are running over capacity.
The good news is that we help over 215,000 people each year. But the saddest side of that story is we turn away almost one in two people that we are able to help. So there's a massive amount of unmet need out there in the community. Needed is more and more secure funding for our services so that we can help the people out there in the community that really need it most. You know, when you're talking to someone who's about to lose their house or about to lose their child, about to lose their job, it is very, very hard to say no that we can't help them just because we don't have the capacity.
According to Nasima Raj, successful legal cases act as a living testament to the continued need for community legal services in Australia. So while the status quo seems to be remaining in place for the time being, the sector is no more certain of its funding than it has been in the past.
So the impact that the uncertainty has on people that need access to free legal services is that it's very difficult for the community legal centres that they go to plan ahead. So we've been on about the last 5 years, we've been on 2-year agreements. And what that means is services aren't able to plan where they'll be in more than a year's time. Many staff are on tracks. And so it creates uncertainty in the community and services kind of come and go at the whims of funding.
The bosses of the centres themselves have had to start saying to staff that they're going to lose their jobs. Lots of people have left already because they didn't have any funding certainty.
For Polly Porteous, the hard work continues for a sector in constant need of extra resources.
But across the country, it doesn't mean that, you know, the problem is solved. There are still thousands of Australians who just can't get access to free legal services. And so we need to keep advocating for that. But certainly it's really reassuring that the Commonwealth Attorney General has agreed to not put the cuts through.
Polly Porteous ending that report. Science has traditionally claimed an objective, apolitical status, but US President Trump's policies have been so divisive they've brought scientists out into the street. Protesters in 600 cities worldwide marched on main streets to challenge the contempt they say they've been treated with. With more than just of demands, they want a new politics, one that sees scientists at the heart of processes. Tom Allinson was at the Sydney March.
390 years ago, the English philosopher Francis Bacon laid out his vision of utopia, an ideal society run by scientists for the benefit of a good and enlightened society. With thousands protesting for a greater role for science in politics this weekend, Speaker Eva Cox told ralliers that vision could be just around the corner.
Utopia, and I'm using Oscar Wilde's definition, is the next island to the one you just landed on. In other words, it's a vision of the fact that we can create positive change.
On Saturday, protesters gathered across more than 600 cities worldwide demanding that change in response to US President Trump's denial of climate change and a broader anti-science stance. In Sydney, ralliers arrived for a range of reasons.
What brings you down?
Well, I've been chronically ill for over half my life, so without science I wouldn't be alive.
I think we've known for decades, if not like a good couple of hundred years, how to solve world hunger, how to lower the working week, you know, how to lift the burden of drudgery off a lot of humanity, and it hasn't been done. And it's not because the science isn't there, it's because, well, we live in a system that puts profit ahead of everything else.
I'm a scientist, so, and I'm really worried about the change in reduction in funding and also the culture now that says we should believe what we read on the internet regardless of who wrote it, rather than actually asking scientists. And just both in our media and in our politicians, this growing trend, I think, of distrust in science.
That distrust was a key theme among both protesters and speakers. One of them was economist and former Liberal opposition leader John Hewson.
What do you think can explain the growing scepticism of science amongst, say, for example, anti-vaxxers?
Well, a lot of it's been subjected to attack. I mean, look at the attacks we get by the government on renewable energy sector or on climate science. You know, and people saying, oh, you know, remain agnostic, as Howard said, or, you know, be convinced or it's another Y2K problem. You know, it's easy, if you don't actually understand something, it's easy to just to vote against it.
He says scientists need to get political and move beyond just supplying the data.
You've got to go through policy development process, the cabinet process, the parliamentary process, the winning in the community against vested interests. I mean, there are multiple layers of this process. So scientists have to get engaged in that as far as they can and should. The other side, others are going to have to pick it up. But if you keep challenging fake news, in the end they can't demonstrate it, can they?
Prominent science communicator Dr. Carl goes one step further.
Sure, it's been a great march, but if that's all that there is, we've failed. We've got to keep the momentum going. And what I reckon is that people should go into politics. You're angry at somebody in there because they're a politician, because they got 77 votes. OK, you run for politics. But you probably need some crowdfunding. You're probably looking at about $5 million. I reckon with $5 million, you could get a drover's dog elected to Parliament.
Dr. Carl says people are no less sceptical of experts than they. A recent Tim Up, with 82% of Australians saying they want politicians to rely more on science. But he says both sides of mainstream politics is letting scientific research down.
With regard to the Labor Party, when they were off a grave free about 10 years ago, instead of saying, what do we have to do? What, just give you the dirt and you'll provide everything else, $1 billion worth? Sure, we'll take it. Instead of saying yes, they said no. Secondly, on the other side of politics, you have a statement. Let me just get you the exact quoting of this statement. What Australia needs, and I quote, is get yellow things pushing dirt around so we can get this nation moving, unquote. That is a quote from the current Deputy Prime Minister of Australia, and I think we need possibly higher levels of innovation.
Sociologist and civil advocate Eva Cox says our current model of tying science funding to industries that rely on profits is discrediting size of the public.
Science sells its soul to industry. Who's going to be doing the stuff that is important that isn't going to make a profit? Who's going to research for the drugs that aren't going to make lots of money for Big Pharma? We've already got a problem because Big Pharma's not looking at creating new antibiotics because they don't make enough money out of them. You know, you can't run a country on the basis of what makes money. And if you've got a disillusioned set of voters who believe that the government's not on their side, this is what you're creating. This is why we have these populist things, because people don't believe the government's on their net.
For that, science and scientists need a new politics.
When you're banging a wall, learn to identify the loose bricks. We need to find the politicians who do listen, often younger ones who mightn't be in the top positions now, in the more junior ministries, who need to find people that will go and them about the broad issues about what science should be doing and not just complaining about it. And we need to put up some good science policies about money should be going and how we should fund things that are working for the common good, not get to patent them and make money out of them.
Eva Cox, ending that, Robinson, the Department of Ocean and Science was... Well, the French elections have finally given us choice of... And to shed some more light on the issue, we have Roderick Chambers.
Well, for once, the polls appear to be correct in the French elections, and the candidates Emmanuel Macron with his On the Move party and the far-right's Marine Le Pen's National Front will be the candidates for the French election in 2 weeks. Professor Bruce Bilson, director of RMIT's Centre for European Studies, explains that the head-to-head contest will now decide the French presidency.
Yes, it is indeed. The runoff is on the 7th of May. And it is the practice always is with the presidential elections that there is one runoff, and there were 11 candidates yesterday. That is narrowed down to two on the 7th of May. So it's now a head-to-head between Macron and Le Pen.
As happened when Marine Le Pen's father forced his way into the presidential elections over 10 years ago, the other candidates have almost all endorsed Emmanuel Macron to try and block the election of Le Pen, who would be seen, well, Emmanuel Macron would be seen as the better alternative. Would Macron garner then the most second round support? Professor Wilson again.
The short answer is yes. I haven't seen a very recent poll, but some couple of weeks ago the polls were suggesting that if it was Macron and Le Pen in the second, Macron might expect to garner something like 60% of the votes. And it's interesting that already, immediately after the declaration of this ballot, or the apparent outcome of this ballot, that both the senior conservative participant in this first round, Fillon, and the representative of the Socialist Party, Hamon, have endorsed Macron and recommended that their supporters vote for him in the second round on 7th of May. So I think you would expect him to win fairly convincingly.
Dr. Natalie Doyle is from Monash University's European Studies Centre, and she sees polarising differences between the centre-left leaning Emmanuel Macron and the right populist candidate Marine Le Pen. She explains here how she sees Macron.
Macron was in fact
not a politician to start with. He started a new political movement when he announced his presidential campaign. But he does have political experience within the French political system. Somebody can be ungoverned without actually having ever been elected. So he served as economics minister under socialist government. So that was under the presidency of François Hollande. So that's his political experience. Otherwise, he's got a background in the high public service.
And so that's quite a bit for someone of his age. Is he a bit of a Justin Trudeau type candidate, do you think?
That's an interesting comparison. I'm often asked whether he is a French version to Tony Blair. I always say yes. But in fact, Trudeau sounds like a very good comparison.
I see.
Because there is a generational factor. He is young. Provides a fairly original synthesis of very progressive social values on such issues as, same-sex marriage, providing public funding for IVF, for lesbian couples, say, right? And at the same time, he's quite conservative when it comes to economic policy. He is, in fact, very much in support of a liberal economic policy along the lines of what has been promoted primarily by the German government.
So it sounds like it's going to be a pretty clear choice, given Marine Le Pen probably has opposite positions on most of those issues you've just mentioned.
Well, yes, it's totally polarised because, in a sense, both candidates represent two sides of France. They represent the appearance of a new divide, which is obviously not just visible in France but in other Western countries. Those who are for opening up and those who are for closing, and it's obviously linked to where they sit with respect to the appearance of a new global economy. As well as, obviously, issues to do with progressive social norms, as I've already mentioned. So it's very polarised. They are appealing to two very different sectors of French society.
The problem is going to be at the June elections, as this is for the legislature, as neither candidate has a political base.
I think that the short answer is that the unions will certainly struggle with some of the things that Macron wants to do. But for some years now, the French economy has been sluggish. You've got unemployment sitting solidly around 10%. You've unemployment amongst young people, 18 to 24, much higher, mid-20s, 26%, something like that. So if he can make the argument that his reforms are going to address those serious structural problems in the French economy and that are affecting French living standards, that's the kind of ground he'll need to work on. Of course, there's another significant step. Let's assume that Macron does become president on the 7th of May. The French then have legislative elections in June, again, two rounds of voting for their parliament, the Assembly, the National Assembly, and he, of course, has no political base with which to campaign in those legislative elections. So he will be dependent on the way in which he can negotiate with both the Socialist Party and Les Républicains in order to be able to get policy measures through the National Assembly.
The situation is not unprecedented, however, as there has been a legislature in conflict with the President of France in the past. So we will wait to see the outcome with bated breath.
Roderick Chambers ending that report. Ever since their introduction in the 19th century, European carp have become an ever-growing pest species in Australian waterways. The Australian government has announced their plan to release a herpes virus attacking the carp. The result of Carpageddon is an expensive clean-up bill to clear the carcasses. However, native endangered species could provide a helping hand. Chris Jansen has this report.
The Murray-Darling Basin is a key site for marine biology and ecology in New South Wales. However, after being introduced by British settlers in the 19th century, European carp have taken over the site, now accounting for 83% of all fish in the area. The introduced and invasive species is causing so much concern that in May of 2016, Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce addressed the Parliament with his thoughts on the nasty pest, as well as the contribution that the Australian government would make.
It was great to be able to announce the $15 million that we will put towards the eradication of carp. We are afflicted in this nation, we are afflicted with this bottom-dwelling, mud-sucking creatures, for which the only form of control is a version of herpes to try and get rid of these disgusting mud-sucking creatures.
However, due to their sheer numbers, carp are starting to pose a serious threat. Dr. Keller Kopf is a professor in aquatic ecology at Charles Sturt University and acknowledges the harm that they are causing.
Carp are also the most abundant species of fish in the Murray-Darling Basin. They comprise anywhere between 60 to 90% of all fish biomass. As a result of that, they're consuming a huge amount of the food resources that are available for native fish to eat.
Therefore, the pledged $15 million is in part going towards the study of what Mr. Joyce earlier referred to as a herpes control, a virus which could be released into the Murray River purely to target the carp. The virus has been extremely effective in eradicating carp in other parts of the world, and Dr. Kopf believes this would offer multiple benefits to our waterways.
By effectively controlling carp with the release of koi herpes virus, we're potentially freeing up a lot of food resources for native fish and potentially having impacts on improving water quality, reducing the amount of sediments that are present in the water column. There's a whole range of potential impacts that carp have on ecosystems, and by releasing this virus, we're hoping that we'll see some benefit for native species and aquatic ecosystems more generally in the Murray-Darling.
There is a problem with this approach, though, that has ominously been named Carpageddon. The virus is expected to be extremely effective, leaving behind a plethora of carp carcasses that Mr. Joyce believes will be difficult to deal with.
But we don't want to have to deal with carp. We've got to get rid of the carp. We've got to deal with this virus. Do you know, Mr. Speaker, that we're going to have between 500,000 and 2 million tonnes of carp? We'll have to bury the carp, we'll have to put it outside, put it in the paddocks.
While scientists have suggested that some of the dead carp would actually decompose naturally, the reality is that the physical removal would cost $1 million for the New South Wales government alone. However, there is a cheaper solution that also has potential to help some native Australian wildlife. Scavengers such as turtles and crayfish would happily relish the opportunity to help clean up. But Dr. Ricky Spencer, an associate professor in ecology at the University of Western Sydney, species might miss the banquet.
The scavengers in the system, the tayfish, other fish, could be really important for the cleanup of the carp. That's what their job is, to basically clean up dead things in the river. The problem is that many of our scavengers are actually on the decline themselves.
40% of worldwide turtle species are at risk of extinction, making them the most vulnerable group of animals to inhabit the earth. Miss Katie Howard, a doctorate student at the University of Western Sydney who specialises in turtles, fears for our shelled friends.
Bruce Chessman's work along the Murray, he detected really severe declines, both in the population themselves but also the number of juveniles. And in some areas, the number of juveniles reduced from 25 or 28% to zero. So you're definitely talking about ongoing, persistent issues.
One suggestion to benefit the turtles is a concept referred to as headstarting, a process of breeding turtles in captivity and then releasing them to take care of the carp.
So that's what headstarting is, essentially protecting the eggs, incubating them, raising them, and then releasing them into the river. And then essentially we can release these vacuum cleaners at the river throughout, you know, a whole range of different regions.
Ms. Howard believes that we need to be careful with implementing such a process.
So head starting sort of goes around the issue without directly solving the problems as to why the turtles have declined in the first place. And sometimes that tactic can be used as a short-term tactic whilst you work out how to deal with the other issues.
Nevertheless, while the turtles would undoubtedly benefit from Carpageddon, Dr. Kopf remains realistic in the exact amount of assistance they could provide.
I think that turtle and crayfish populations are likely to benefit from the mass mortalities of carp, but at the same time, it's, in my opinion, pretty unlikely that they're going to be able to consume enough of the dead carp to make much of a dent in the total biomass of fish.
One thing is for sure, though, Mr. Joyce seems clearly determined in the objective of the Australian government.
We want the Murray to be a healthy river. We on the coalition are going to make sure that we have a healthy river, because we're going to get rid of the carp.
Australian Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce emphatically ending that report by Chris Jansen. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all our stories online at thewire.org.au, or you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your favourite download app. The Wire is a team effort by 2SER, Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane, and you can hear us on your radio or online across Australia weekdays. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of 2SER 107.3 in Sydney. I'm Oscar Wills. Thanks for your company.
SER is a volunteer-based community radio station owned and operated by the University of Technology Sydney and Macquarie University. As a member of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia, 2SER abides by the Community Radio Code of Practice. If you wish to make a complaint about material you've heard on 2SER, you can contact the station during office hours on 9514 9514 or write to the program manager, 2SER, PO Box 123, Broadway, 2007. 2SER policies can be seen on our website, www.2ser.com. And home.